This episode is sponsored by United Refrigeration and Westermeyer Industries, revolutionizing your HVACR experience. Visit URI.com for all your HVACR needs, offering real-time inventory, personalized pricing, and a nearby stock feature. Access quick pick replacement parts and branch details effortlessly. With 350-plus fully stocked locations across North America, our knowledgeable staff are ready to assist with the solutions you need. Exclusive offer. Use code ARPOD on URI.com to get a $10 gift card when purchasing the Westermeyer Oil Float, part number W4300-38F. These high-performance floats are not just compatible with their own oil separators, but also available as a crossover model. Conveniently stocked at United Refrigeration. That's code ARPOD to claim your $10 gift card. Visit URI.com now.
The Sporland Division of Parker Hannifin Corporation is sponsoring this podcast. Sporland is the leading manufacturer of HVAC and R components. Using quality materials and craftsmanship, Sporland maintains a commitment to innovation, manufacturing excellence, service, and support for its customers since 1934. The company is known for its catch-all filter dryers, thermostatic expansion valves, solenoid valves, pressure regulating valves, suction filters, electric valves, controllers, supermarket monitoring solutions, chemicals, smart service tools, ZoomLock Max Press to Connect, and ZoomLock Push to Connect refrigerant fittings. If folks want to learn more, what do they do?
You can go to Sporland.com.
I guess that's Jim and John for Sporland signing off.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Advanced Refrigeration Podcast. You're with your host, Brett Wetzel and Kevin Compass. What do you got going on this week, buddy?
A boring week. I was cutting a bunch of train controls over to Copeland, Emerson, or whatever. I don't know. I keep calling it CBC. It's been CBC for... So we're cutting over a bunch of train controls. They control a bunch of pumps and VFDs and BLEMO actuators and all kinds of crazy stuff. So I've been cutting over that. So I spent my week trying to pull BACnet points out of train controls. So learning how to use BACnet Explorer to pull points out of controls, because the train HIM interface, which is like their little LCD screen, was bad. So I couldn't see anything. Awesome. And I had to pull all these set points out of there. So I was messing around with that, and I figured that out. And that was cool to mess around with. And yeah, so I've been messing around with that a little bit and messing around with some other stuff. And then I got that done and then drained a bunch of water loops down, because we're changing the rack at this place. It's probably one of the first CO2 racks in the country. This thing's 11 years old. So I've been draining down all these water loops we had to take down some coils to get this rack room in, or this rack in the room. So mess around with that. And then just doing like a lot of quoting and some CO2 troubleshooting for guys.
How's that train thing going? Because I was wondering how the hell you were programming. I like to see that when it's all done. I'd assume that because you're doing it basically from scratch on CPC, or is someone helping you do that?
So the interface, we're doing both. So it's between CPC and me. And then the actual like train integration, because they're keeping some of the train boards.
Oh, really?
So the air handlers have train boards in them. They have they're real tech boards, so okay, they can talk to those. So Travis Long's doing integration for those, so they're pulling those on BACnet. So basically I have two BACnet comm loops. We're picking up
Hold on. Did you tell Travis Long that Oklahoma is the Ohio of the South? Because he lives in Oklahoma.
I know he lives in Oklahoma.
Anyway, so you're doing, they're doing
definitely no Texas. So there's two backnet loops on that, that they're picking up all the VFDs. So all the Dan Foss drives are picking up. So they're doing all that. And then there's also all the BTU meters, which is cool. Like, I've never really messed with these before. They're actually measuring flow and temperature, and they're figuring out like the BTU content of what the heat exchangers are doing.
Okay.
So that those are getting picked up. And then there is a ton of Modbus lighting controls that got to get done. So they're doing all that. I'm doing the programming for the intermediate stuff, pumps and stuff. And then we got to figure out how to make this all work in the field, because it's existing. It's existing, and there's a sequence operation of what was there, but it really didn't work. So
usually the way the thing works is it has that one pressure transducer, right, on the main train board. And then as soon as it usually opens up first, I'm sorry, it stays closed and then opens up all the rest of the dampers and gets a baseline of what the static pressure is. And then usually tries to just sit there and maintain that static pressure as the thing goes on. If everything's rolling and the bypass damper shut, theoretically that should be the static pressure on the system. But if you're calling for a system, for all the systems except for maybe one, that one closes off, the static pressure is going to increase, and essentially that pressure transducer is there. So it knows by opening up that bypass X amount, that's, you know, keeping that static pressure on what the unit was on the startup. So unfortunately, you're probably gonna have to roll through all those things and make sure the dampers in fact are either.
None of these are VAVs. No, it's the flows for the actual like glycol loops. No, like these are just air handlers with VFDs. So they are variable speed, but they're just double deck air handlers. So chill water, cool, hot water.
Oh, I thought you meant when you went VAV, because I thought you said VAV, and I'm thinking bypass dampers. And
all. No, I'm sorry, it's variable. It's the variable glycol loops, but yeah, it's a little bit overkill for what it is, but I don't know. The panel turned out nice. I got the panel from them, and I'm looking at it and I go, this isn't going to fit.
So essentially each one of those units is hot deck, cold deck.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Makes more sense now.
Yeah. Each one's hot deck, cold deck. There's only four of them. So like that's not going to be that bad. The thing that worries me the most is all the wires that weren't marked that I had to tone out. So I'm a little bit happier that I know where stuff is, but it was a hassle trying to pull comm loops. And then I'm trying to pull wires and I realized that they literally packed all the conduit. I broke two fish tapes. I broke like two spare wires trying to pull stuff through. I was not happy.
Do know that there's like a limit. You're supposed to only go 3/4 of the actual conduit for capacity, right?
Yeah, nobody gave a shit here apparently. Oh. But that's with current carrying wires. Yeah, nobody seems to care with shielded cable. It's always an afterthought because nobody inspects it.
Yeah. Are you in where are you at? You're at home?
Yeah, I'm at home this week.
Okay. So. I'm used to like going in states where they're like, free hang everything. But I know certain states they're like, nope, if it's accessible to any damage, it can't be free hung or whatever.
So it's always been like a customer thing.
Really?
Like out here, like nobody cares. It's always been like a customer thing. Some customers are cool with it being in bridle rings and some customers want it in conduit. I absolutely hate it when it's in conduit because usually it's a nightmare to pull. And to be honest, I think wire gets damaged pulling through conduit more, especially shielded cable, than it does pulling through bridle rings.
Yeah.
Definitely, to me, it just catching on something, it's not good. But I don't know, so I've been messing around with that. And then today I was piping some cases, so an easy, you know, brainless day.
Gotcha. You haven't done anything. I've done stuff, but we're starting a new program at work for people that don't know anything about refrigeration. And it's been face down trying to get all that stuff prepped and ready in order to do that. So fun.
That's cool.
Yeah. So what the hell were we talking about tonight? I have no idea. I could bring up this. I got the router working. I could bring that up real quick.
You want to talk about that first?
Sure. Yeah, let's see. Share screen. Entire screen. This is going to be a mishmash of just shit we're going to talk about, just random stuff.
Random stuff.
Yeah, that's probably what we'll just call it. We'll just call it random shit. So here, so Kevin was asking me about something for hooking up to an E2 and on a mini router. So the mini router looks like... What the hell's the mini router look like? Nope, not that. Nah. All right, yeah, there it goes. Mini router right here. That's what the mini router looks like. That one right there. Except for that's a whole bunch of German stutch. But no, so what you have to do when you first log into this, like usually that you'll get a user, the user will just be admin and then the password. So let me just start off from scratch. 192, there we go. 192.168.0.1. That's usually like the straight login for this guy. And usually it'll ask you for a password. I had to reset my password and because I forgot what it was. So it reset the whole router. So awesome. So when you're setting up one of these, one of the things you want to do right away before you do everything and you're like, ah, I got to mess that up, is go to security. Enable SIP, SPI firewall. Get rid of that thing. And I'm pretty sure I disabled all this other shit too. Because I didn't want to have anything in there that was going to basically stop me from having to connect. So I save that. And then the next thing I went to was this right here. So this is what I was talking about right here, Kev.
Yep. Where
I said put the range, right? And so then you can type in any IP address of that in the router, and it should basically bring you up to if you have the E2 Ultratype hooked up. This is how I was doing it. The way that you were telling me how it was hooked up, I have no idea how they're doing that. But so let's just say you have an IP address that's 192.168.0.150, and then your next controller is 151 and 152. This is where I said make the range right here, and then that'll basically cover everything there. So you should theoretically then be able to hook up to whatever controller that you're doing via changing this IP address right here. And then you keep this here because this is the IP address that you're basically going to be hooking up to here if you have to change any of that. Because if you have to hook up to another controller at another store, that's where you'd basically change this range. So you might have a store that's 1.6 something totally different than another store, and then that way you can put the new range in there for actually connecting up to an E2, and it's really helpful. Like I had this hooked up to a rack, I was probably 150 feet away, and I could still hook up to it. And then the same thing too, you can hook this up to I think the either E0 or E1, ETH1 or ETH0 port on the E3, and you can do the same damn thing. Just make sure the range is there. And you should be able to hook straight up to it.
So can you forward a port on here? Go to forwarding.
There we go. Can add new. So what do they have typed in?
It was port 3001.
And then he just, so that's what you, where did you type in 3001 though? Like I don't.
That's in Ultrasight. So under Ultrasight, you have the IP address and then right below it, you have the port number.
Oh, so then you just put the IP address in here. Oh, so wait, keeping this empty, internal port requires service port. See this? I don't understand how the virtual server thing works. I don't know. I've never done that of the forwarding the ports. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I got to do some reading on this because I'm going to mess around with that site supervisor. I'm going to forward the port on it and see what it does.
And see if you can get it on the internet and cross it over, be able to hook up to it remotely.
Yeah. I had it at one point on our old router at the old house when I had the E2 hooked up. I was able to get on it. And I forwarded the port. I don't remember how I did it, but it worked. And I don't know. I haven't really messed around with it since. But
well, that's what I want to do. I have an unswitched port where all the I have a 255, the E3, the 880, and the E2 are all going to connect up to. So in case I need to connect onto it because I'm trying to figure something out, this way I can just log into it, log in through the unmanaged switch, and then, bam, just be able to log into it using the port forwarding.
Yeah, I think you have to forward the port on the actual your actual router for the house.
But then you have to make it a static, you have to make it a solid port all the time, because my understanding, it changes, right?
Well, it changes on, so I have Starlink and I notice my IP is the same all the time.
Really?
I haven't noticed it in like the last 8 months. I haven't seen it change.
Hmm. Interesting.
That may be the same. I got to do some reading with this and figure it out.
But yeah, so essentially when you set this up to start, if you go, like I said, to the DHCP, this is where you put the ranges and make sure whatever device that you're connecting to is right in the middle of that. And then the same thing with the, what the hell was it? I just had it. Security. Oh, there we go. Security. I just disabled all this stuff because I didn't want it to basically interfere with the with anything I was trying to connect to. Because I took the time, I reset up a new password and everything. And I was like, oh, this is going to be really easy, because usually you have to use the little number that's in the bottom, and I'm getting old and can't really read it all that well without my glasses. So I was like, let's just delete it. And then I had to switch it back because I didn't disable any of the security shit first. So it's fun times.
Yeah, it's go ahead.
No, I just, I don't know. I'm not a pro at all this stuff. I got peoples that know better than I do for that
stuff. Oh, exactly. Like I usually ask people that stuff. Like my brain sometimes can't just literally take some of that stuff. And it's
like anything else. If you don't use it, you just, cause what you, once it's set up and you're like, oh, then whatever, you know what I mean?
And like the networking stuff generally isn't our problem. But it's becoming more and more, just like with the SC3 stuff. Dude, I never really, I hated doing Ethernet cables. Despised it. Like making Ethernet cable crimps, like I was never good at it. Like now it's like you do it all the time, because it's like just troubleshooting SC3 stuff, or like even the CC200s with the Ethernet stuff. Like I you have to learn like getting a cable checker and like checking cables. Like it's become like a huge thing because half the electricians can't make cable ends.
I'm wondering if you could basically throw this on the end of the CC200.
Why not?
That's what I'm saying. Like you could potentially, you know, hook this up to it, or a line of S3Cs, and maybe it might be able to pick up all of them.
It should. I'd imagine the SC3 interface, like remotely, has got to be way better off like a computer.
I gotta get off my ass and hook that CC200 up. I have a CC200 sitting right there, and I haven't had the freaking time.
They still owe me a CC200.
So I used a whole bunch of potentiometers, because these are the potentiometers that I use for hooking stuff up. So I got the precision ones, because if you try to use something other than the precision ones, like you cough on it and all of a sudden it'll go from 2 degrees up to 40 degrees. So I use these precision potentiometers. I use the 10K ones that usually get me good for the pressure. And the way I figured that out is I hooked it up to a signal generator, because I wanted to make sure I didn't blow anything up important first. So I was like, oh, if I blow up a signal generator, it's not going to hurt anything. So I hooked it up to the signal generator and basically hooked it up like you do a pressure transducer using all three ports, and hooked it up. And as I turned it, the voltage out changed. And I was like, oh, okay, 10K works really well. So that's what I use for that. Unfortunately, with the precision potentiometers there's only precision ones that only go up to 100K. I couldn't find anything else. Like to be a true blue potentiometer to cover all the range of a CPC sensor, you would need like a 2 or 300K because of the ranges. So the only bad thing about using the precision ones to simulate temperatures, you can use 100K, but it only gets you down to -5 degrees. So the only other thing you could do is you use a resistor in series with it and just add a little bit of resistance, but then that kind of limits your top end there. And then for Danfoss ones, if you want to simulate those temperature sensors, I usually use a 2K one. Because that, even though they're a PT1000, that, whatchamacallit, that 2K will get you all the way down to get almost the full range of what a temperature sensor was. So you can essentially just sit with a case controller and simulate temperatures on trainers and stuff, and you can watch the valves open and shut. And that's what I plan on doing with the iPro and that.
I was using 500K ones, and for the most part, they were okay. It was randomly, if you had a certain spot, though, like I had it marked, it would just make the input go open.
But that's what I'm saying. But you were using just the one that has single turn, right?
Correct.
Yes. So that's the bitch of it. So with the precision ones, you have actual 10 turns on there. So you know how like you would just sneeze on it and all of a sudden it goes up like 30 degrees? Because you can get the regular standard single turn.
All day long.
Yeah, but using the precision one, if you're like trying to do superheat in that, you're like just touching it and it'll go up 20 degrees.
So I use those all the time. Like I use them for the test and demand cooling. Yeah. So I have one that I soldered to a little whip, and that's what I test demand cooling modules with now, because I hate the way that they tell you to test in the manual. Unhook the sensor. Hook is short the sensor out. It really doesn't tell you if it's the module or if it's the sensor, because we had a rash of demand cooling modules where they were like tripping at random temperatures. And we were able to figure that out with using the potentiometer. I ended up hooking it up there and I was able to put it at the exact temperature it should start injecting. And then I was putting it like 15, 20 degrees under where it should lock out. And it was locking out like 30 degrees below where it should lock out. So that's how I test demand cooling modules now. And it works fairly well. So potentiometers are great. I keep one in my like pack out on my tool cart. It's a great thing to test stuff with.
So that it looks like here, hold on, let me bring this up. Because I was wondering, so we have one hooked up. So at our training center out in Fullerton, we don't have a demand cooling module, but we're constantly looking at what the head temperature is. And I'm pretty sure in the E2, you can actually select type of sensor, and one of them is 86K. And I think, hold on, 86.
So those are the white or CPC sensors. Like they're white high temp sensors.
Yeah, but I think they put a range in here. So I'm looking right now. I'm looking at this guy right here. Usually, whatever it's called. All right, so this is 90,000 ohms at 77 degrees. So I think that'd be a 90K, right?
Yeah.
Maybe. So it looks like you'd have, in order for it to get it in the test voltage, shit, it wouldn't even work. I don't know what that. It would be a lower ohm then. Because wherever it opens and closes. So what temp? I forget what temperature. No, it's 1500 ohms is where it opens and closes, right?
I believe so.
It would have to be, because look, so right at 109 degrees, right, is 42,000. And look, it's going down as the temperature goes up. Dude, where the hell is that alarm range? I want to say it's 1500. Because I'm just trying to figure out, since you're talking about it, what potentiometer did you use for that?
I believe it's a 50K. It's either a 50K or a 100K.
Oh, right here. Ah, okay. So look, no. So look, a 2 or a 5K would work perfect. Because
it might have been a 5.
Yeah, a 5K would work perfect because look, especially if it's precision, because you can see 1700 is when it actually alarm contacts where they trip out, right? You have the 2400 is when it feeds, and 2100 is when I'm sorry, 2100 is when it starts feeding, 2400 is when it stops feeding. So if you used a 3K or a 5K precision, that would get you really in the wheelhouse there.
Yeah, it may have been like a 10K or a 5K.
Yeah, yeah.
It was whatever I had in my cart. I was making a bunch of trainers at the time, and it was just whatever I grabbed, but it works like flawlessly. Like you got to go slow with it. I just take my ohm meter and I just set it to where it should be, and then I just move it as I'm going, and it works great.
So I want to show this. I usually show this in classes when I teach. So BAPI has a whole bunch, because BAPI makes sensors for
basically everybody.
Yeah, they make them for everything. So if you type in, I don't know, PT1000 BAPI, usually I do BAPI resistance chart or whatever. 1K PT. There you go. Oh, that's Stirling. Whatever, that'll still come up. Hold on. I just want to usually come there. Everyone can see how bad that I can't spell.
I can't say anything.
Do I spell like shit? Damn it. All right, BAPI's shitting out of luck for right now, but usually it'll tell you what your resistance is. So negative 200. Yeah, so negative 200 would be, which one? Yeah, this is PT1000. So 1000 ohms would be probably 77 degrees if I had to guess. That goes really far down. Hold on. 70. Yeah, so there's your resistance, and then there's your temperature. Like I said, I think I bought 2K sensors for this, because that brings you all the way up to 250 degrees, and then it'll bring you all the way down to negative 20, negative 30 by going up to 800 ohms. So that'll get you in the range. Same thing with all these other ones, like a 10K2. See, this is what they usually look like. And anytime you hear someone say, oh, it's a 10K sensor. Yeah, it's a 10K at 77 degrees. So that's usually a standard. So if you look up a 2K sensor, same deal. The thing about this is, so sensors are not linear, which kind of sucks because you can't really plot where they are. The reason being, so you have a 10K2, which is your standard CPC or microthermal or some RDM. RDM uses the same thing. But you have other sensors like the 10K3, which is what they have on those little itty bitty. They have the dick cells that you buy off the shelf over at United, where the range down where it hits down to about 32 degrees, it changes, or 40, somewhere in 40 degrees, it changes, where it'll still be, when it's in the higher temperature, when it's at 77 degrees, it'll still be 1,000 ohms, but it changes briefly. Actually, let me see if I can bring this up. Vapi 10K3. Dude, the output table.
That is the only thing that sucks about temp sensors, is most of them aren't linear.
No, it'd be cool, because then you can use the linear interpolator and actually bring it up. Oh, seriously, come on. There we go. I accept. But yeah, so if you have this one over here, and I'm going to bring it up like this, so you can see, I'm just going to do a side-by-side comparison here. So still at 77 degrees, it's still 10,000 ohms, but you can see as you go lower here. Oh, that's lame.
What?
Because I had it all cool and it was showing up on my screen, but I'm not sharing both at the same time. Share screen, entire window. There we go. There we go. So you can see 77, 10,000, 77, 10,000, same, right? But then, like I said, as you get further on down the line, when you go lower in temperature, look, 37 degrees is 25,948, and 37 here is 28,365. So it's, because I'd asked the question the one time, I was like, can I use a CPC sensor on one of those dig cells? And the four people are like, yeah, just throw it in there. It's the same thing. It's 10K is 10K. This is where I found out it wasn't, because I almost left and I was like, because I was looking at the chart and versus what my thermistor probe was saying, and it was like, it's 10 degrees off. I was like, what the hell? And so what I found out is the lower in temperature it got, the difference in resistance got worse. So when it did that, I almost ended up causing a problem, because it was so low. It basically would have ended up causing me to pull the case down lower than what it should have been. And then it would have not terminated at the right temperature, because it was a medium temp unit. So it would have thought that it was at 48 degrees and still would have been at like 38. So it would have prematurely terminated.
Can't you change those to 10K type threes?
But it was using like three different sensors. So I would have had to change the whole thing. It's not like you can't change one single input on there, right? If you change all of them for 10K2, then, or 10K2 to 10K3, then you would have had to change all the sensors. But it was utilizing two or three of the temperature sensors.
Today's episode is sponsored by the RefRush Shield RDP series differential pressure monitors from Westermeyer Industries, now available for transcritical CO2 systems in addition to other common pressures and refrigerants. When the filter element of your coalescing oil separator is contaminated, it can hurt your system's performance and efficiency. But how do you know when it's time to replace that filter? Wait too long to replace, and you could end up with a nasty filter blowout. But replacing too often can be a waste of time and money. The answer is installing a differential pressure monitor. The RDP series differential pressure monitors, including the new transcritical CO2 model, are available now from Westermeyer Industries. To find out more information, email sales@westermeyer.com. That's westermeyer.com.
Ass in that situation. Yeah. No, it's the potentiometers are like awesome for that kind of stuff. Speaking of PT1000, like I just figured this out the other day. We had a Gutner gas cooler controller where it was doing the actual control, and they have those goofy sensors that are like impossible to find. You have to get them from them. Mm-hmm. Those, the ones they use for the drop leg.
Yeah.
So you could actually change it to a PT-1000 Danfoss sensor.
I thought we talked about that. Not on here, but I think because I was asking you which sensor it was, and you're like, oh, no, it's a microthermal sensor. It was the 10K2 or whatever. And I was like, I was reading the book, and I saw it said.
So they have a really weird sensor. I don't know exactly what it is. It's like a, it almost looks like a Danfoss sensor, like those orange discharge sensors, but it's not, because it's not a PT-1000. It's some random one. But though, you in that Gutner controller, if it's running in standalone mode and it's running off a drop leg temp, you could actually take and change that input to a PT-1000, because this thing was down and was reading like minus 15. So it was shutting the fans off, and the rack didn't so much appreciate that. And so I was actually able to take it and change it with the guy over the phone remotely to a PT-1000. And that way, like, he'd throw a Danfoss sensor on there and be done with it.
Yeah, but didn't you have, did you have to change the other sensors that were on there then?
No, you could change that, just that input.
Really?
So you could change just that input to a PT-1000, which is nice because Danfoss sensors are pretty common. So yeah. If you lose one of those Gutner sensors, you could, or like a pad sensor, you could still change it. The only one you can't change is the humidity sensor, which you have to get from them.
Unless you find out what the range is, right?
Yeah, it's some like random weird German humidity sensor. And you can always lock the water on. That's what I did the last door.
And just lock it on until you get it?
But yeah, because otherwise it shuts the water off. So if the humidity sensor fails, the water shuts off. And if the water...
I wonder what it is. I wonder what it is, though, because like you could do the same damn thing with a pot, right? You could hook up a pot and make it a high... Hold on.
Yeah, maybe read a high humidity level.
No, because I see, I'm not sure, because you... Or low. I was going to say low. You'd want to do low humidity, because otherwise it's going to be like, oh, no, it's humid enough. You don't need any water.
Yeah. Once those things are dialed in, they work fairly well. It's just tweaking here and there. But I don't know. Like, it's, you definitely change one of those Danfoss sensors, and they work fairly well.
Active temperature sensor. I'm looking at the manual now. I don't know if this is the old one or the new one, but... It says the pressure sensor 4 to 20 for an active temperature sensor.
But I've been seeing a lot of 4 to 20 milliamp stuff.
It's more accurate.
It is more accurate, but it's harder for people to troubleshoot.
Why? Because, you know, the range goes from 4 to 20. Like,
but most people don't understand how to do it, and or most, a lot of meters don't have the ability to even read it.
What? What are you talking about? You put it in series.
Yeah, some Fluke meters can't read 4 to 20 milliamps. Yeah.
Hmm.
Especially guys that use those, that Fluke fork meter that just drives me absolutely insane.
All right, well, I'm going to show this since you brought it up. So this only works with shit that's linear. So let me just preface that by saying that. This is a linear interpolator. So they make them for a whole bunch of different, for a whole bunch of different stuff, for an iPhone or an Android. I think linear interpolation master is what it's called on the iPhone. And then I forget what it's called on my Android, because I'm old and I like Androids.
But anyways, Android also. Apple's the devil.
Yeah, but you're the fucking, you're inside, you're a boomer. So here, so this only works for stuff that's linear. So example, so if you have a sensor that's 4 to 20, right? You could put 4 here. You always want to do the voltage and the voltage and or amperage here, and then like your range of that sensor. So you can do a 4 to 20 milliamp, and let's just say the humidity is, I don't know, 0 to 100. Hopefully I picked a good one. So if you measure the amperage, and I don't know, let's just say you get, pick a number, 14.4, right?
Yep.
Calculate. That means that sensor theoretically should read 65% relative humidity. And that goes the same for temperature sensors as well. Or I'm sorry, scratch that. Doesn't go for temperature sensors. I just said doesn't work for temperatures. They're not linear. They don't work. So you can do this for pressure transducers all day long, because you got 40 different styles, right? So we got let's just say a Danfoss one has a 1 to 6 volt range, right? And let's just say, let's do some CO2 in here. What's the range on that? 2 grand?
Yeah.
So we can go 2,000 and you could do zero there. And let's just pick a voltage, any voltage. I won't look.
9.1.
No, you can't do that. It's only 1 to 6.
Oh.
Something in between 1 and 6.
Oh, 3.3.
3.3.
I thought we were still doing 420 milliamps.
No, nope, I skipped. That's what I was saying. Danfoss sensor. All right, bam. That means that technically that pressure transducer at 3.3 volts, if you measured from zero to signal and you got 3.3, theoretically, if there's no offset within the controller, you will get 920 PSI. So same thing with, let's do another one. Let's do sheepy. So let's do 0.5.
4.5.
Yep. And let's just do another CO2 sensor, 2000. And let's just say we still got that 3.3 volts. Delete that. All right. Calculate. 1400. So they make these for the phone. So you can essentially grab, it's going to look like this, a lot like this, where it's going to have an X axis and a Y axis. Always do the voltage on the voltage or amperage on the left-hand side. The reason for that is because you're putting in the precise number that you have. Otherwise, if you did the range, if you did the volt, the pressure range on the other side, the voltage might be off just a hair. So by putting the precise voltage that you're getting there, it works out really well. Same thing with trying to figure out, like I was one for always screwing up how many hertz versus like percentage, right, on the VFD. So if you have, let's delete all this stuff. If you have a 0 volt, and if you have 10 volt for a VFD and it's 60 hertz, if you're an idiot like me that doesn't do, or 60 hertz, where if you're an idiot like me and you can't figure this shit out in your head, then you have this to basically help you out. Now, obviously, if we did 5 volts easily, it's going to be 30 hertz. So let's just do something off the wall, 8.3. Bam. So that means technically, if you have an 8.3 volt signal going to that VFD for let's just say a compressor, then it should be running at 49.8 hertz.
Yeah, no, I use that more now than I ever have, and it's a great tool. Just be careful with your apps. You like, some of the apps are just like way overly complicated.
Yes,
look, find one that's easy. Like you just brought up, like on there, like that you only need that stuff. But some of these apps have a ton of random stuff in there that you don't need.
Yeah, the linear interpolation master that's on the iPhone, it's blue and gray. It's usually like the second one that comes up, and it's fairly easy. And then the one for the Android, and I'll show you that one because I have that one on my phone. It's called Free Linear Interpolator. And it has the same axis. It has the X axis, Y axis, 6 things there. That's all it needs. Same thing with the RPM, right? So if you have... Let's see, what's usually a compressor RPM? 1750, yeah?
Yep.
All right, so we'll do 1750, and I'll stop boring you guys with this shit. Yeah, and let's just say you got, once again, 0 to 10, and we are spinning at, I don't know, give it a 6.9 volts, and we should get 1207.5. So that's how you can tell what RPMs theoretically that thing should be spinning at. Also helpful for percentages, right? If you're trying to figure out what to put in there for your demand cool, or your, I'm sorry, not your demand cooling, your IDCM modules, right? Usually those ranges are, let's see, 1.44 and then 5 volts. And you have a scroll that's running 10% minimum up to 100%. This would be useful because then you can figure out, okay, how much percentage am I running at X, which might actually help you figure out where about your wheel park or your amperage you should be. I don't know, 2.6. So you're at 39%, almost 40% capacity of that compressor. So just a couple different instances that you might be able to use the linear interpolator. Like I said, does not work for temperature sensors. So don't use it unless the temperature sensor that you are using is actually linear, but you'd have to look that up and you'd be a smarter man than I am. So
I haven't really seen any that are.
I don't think so, because it would have to be even, like for every 1 degree, it would have to be X. I was trying to get smart the one day. There's a, because every manufacturer for the HPV controllers, like they'll put what they say for the ranges for this saturated versus another one. And in some of the set points in real deep, there's an X axis and a Y axis. And I was trying to plot it, try to figure out what temperature they thought that what temperature was based off of the linear. And I couldn't get it to work. I couldn't get it to plot out. That's what I was trying to do.
It's got it. Somehow it's got to be plotted in there, obviously, because they're doing it, but it's probably some crazy Excel file that, did freeze. There it goes. No, other than that, we've had some iPro issues, so we've been troubleshooting that. Those are starting to pop back up, high pressure valve issues. So we had a store where randomly we started getting comm issues and started taking down the iPro. It's a 2-year-old store. And So with the iPro, guys, just so you know, you cannot have a grounded transformer feeding the thing.
Wait, 2 years and it took that to happen?
So this was real weird. So it was the manufacturer extended wires, and there was an extended wire in there, and they grounded the shield. You cannot ground the shields on any of the inputs.
Yeah,
because it picks up noise.
Gotcha.
It was taking out the iPro randomly. So there's an issue with the drive compressor, I think, was putting a little bit more noise on the noise out. Mm-hmm. And it was throwing the iPro into a comm loss, which killed the rack, which blew off the reliefs. So ended up having them go through it and clipping all the shields. And as soon as we clipped all the shields, it went away and never happened again.
Really?
So, but just so you guys know, like I've seen this on multiple rack manufacturers. It's still happening coming out like on startup. If they ground the transformer, it's bad news bears for the iPro. It cannot have a grounded transformer.
It's bad news bears for the PIB board as well.
Yes.
It'll usually blow the PIB board. I think they have protection on the E3 now, so I don't think it really blows that shit up.
So, yeah. And then I noticed on a lot of stores with the E2 still, they're starting to send out, Emerson has those, me and you were talking about before, those amplifiers, those like $15, $20 Amazon amplifiers. They're sending those out for stores. So they take the hit instead of the comm port.
Yeah, $1,300 PIB board.
$1,300 PIB board. And so those are taking the hit now. That's one thing. And then now's the time where all these CO2 racks start acting up, where it's getting hot and getting cool, getting hot, getting cool. It's one thing to keep, an eye on, guys. Make sure that the gas coolers are clean and your valves are all functioning properly. Because this is where you're going to start to see them when they start transitioning to transcritical. You're going to start seeing all these high pressure valve issues. We've had a couple where the screens have been like plugged solid. They're still running. They were fine all winter long because they didn't have the pressure behind them.
Mm-hmm.
So actually cleaning those Danfoss valve screens is pumping them down and blowing them down and taking the screens and cleaning them out real good.
Yeah, I heard a lot of different manufacturers starting to put screens right before now.
Y strainers?
Yeah. Actually, I got to send myself a picture here. I show you this one since we're talking about it. There was one that someone sent me. It looks like there's kitty litter.
Is it the one Chance was sending?
Probably.
Yeah, it was bad.
No, there's like wire. It looked like piece of wire, but it was just stretches of stainless in there, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's from like guys installing the shit and not doing a good job cutting pipe and reaming pipe and cleaning it. Obviously, with stainless, there's really no way to cut it besides a bandsaw.
Oh, the stainless?
Yeah, you're not cutting stainless tubing or pipe with a tubing cutter. Like, it's just not happening. Like, You'd be there all day.
Speaking of which, I saw this on the social medias. There was a, I saw that they're starting to make one of those Milwaukee pipe cutters that does up to 2-in-1.
Yeah, the Fitter Killer 5000.
That's what I was about to ask you about, because I know you said you're like, man, when that thing takes a bite out of you, just a little one, the one that does up to like 1 1/8 or whatever, it'll pinch you real bad.
I've seen more guys get fingers stuck in that thing, sweatshirts. That we had a guy, his whole forearm got stuck in it. Like, he was carrying it with like in his like arms, and he had a bunch of pipe and stuff in his arms, and he hit the trigger and it sucked his forearm into it. Like, and the carpenters had to take it apart while it was stuck to his arm, because it was stuck in his arm was stuck in the gears.
Jesus.
Like, that thing's great. Don't get me wrong. I use it all the time.
Are you talking about the real, real big one that I just saw?
No, that like that's a small one. So the big one,
the little one that only does 1 1/8.
Yeah, that.
How small was this guy?
He's actually pretty good built. Like, the problem is it grabs skin. Like, as the head rotates, it'll grab your skin, and once it gets in there, there's no way to reverse it. It'll get you. Like, but I know why it happens, because it's a blind cutter. Like, you stick it in places and you don't realize, and your finger's real close to it, and it'll get you. That one will take your whole arm.
That's what I, like, when I saw it, that was the, because I've heard you talk about it before. You're like, yeah, that thing wants to rip your arm in there a little bit, just the little guy. And I'm like, I'm thinking about the big one. I was like, someone's going to lose an arm. Like, that dude, that's big enough to suck my freaking forearm in.
But I will tell you, I've been waiting a long time for that thing, because doing like retrofits and other stuff where like you're close on 2-inch pipe, like 2 1/8-inch pipe, or up against a wall, like that thing's killer.
The only thing that I found, it was from Shamrock Supply. I have an imp cutter that does 2 5/8.
I have one too. It's a T-Rex.
Yeah. And then there was another thing that someone else showed me where they were talking about potentially using a...
So I have a Wheeler makes it. It's called a T-Rex. That's the 2 5 cutter I have. It's awesome. But like muffler cutters, like we've done that before, like on 3 or 4 inch where we can't get to it. Like, you use a muffler cutter, it leaves a nasty burr though on the outside. So you end up having to take a die grinder to it and chamfer it to get the fitting on. Because once you go over 2 1/8, the fittings are just a absolute bitch to get on.
Yeah. So it's actually one of those. As being a refrigeration guy, like normally you don't have to like clean the fittings. But like when you're dealing with like 1 5/8 above, those fittings start being a pain in the ass if they're not nice and roundy.
So what we do is take the Milwaukee die grinders with sanding discs and we'll bevel them.
Really?
Like bigger pipe, we'll bevel the edges. Like once you get 2 5 and above, bevel the edges, and then you get like a mallet hammer and just beat the living out of it.
Doesn't it get sharp though?
No, you're beveling it like at a 45 degree angle. So like it's not sharp, but it's enough where like it's chamfered enough where you get the pipe on. It makes it a lot smoother. Other than that, you got to heat the living crap out of it to get it to go on there to burn on it.
Yeah.
Doing a 3-inch sucks.
Damn.
But I don't know. That tubing cutter is going to be pretty cool when it comes out.
Until someone loses an arm.
Until somebody loses an arm. Probably me first.
Now I own Milwaukee instead of me owning all the stuff that they own.
Anything we're to call it for tonight?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yep.
Talk to you guys again later.